Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
Chapter 3 of Chasing the Sun by Richard Cohen, the epic story of the star that gives us life. Chapter 3, this one is about building monuments and I suppose the actual physical architecture that's been left behind for solar myths. And the first one is, the first quote, the title is 3,000 Witnesses. Pat Wood from Dartmoor. To lug those stones was quite an undertaking, technology worth some remark. And then the next quote is by L.H. Auden, In Praise of Limestone, whatever fantastic book. The henge means hanging. Is specifically a large Neolithic monument consists of circular bank and earth parallel to the internal ditch and frequently containing a circle of upright stones. Strictly, Stonehenge is not a henge because the position of its bank and ditch are reversed. Mehir is a solitary standing stone and Megalith, a great stone from Mega's Great Lithos stone. Okay, well there you go. And that person said, the poet, admired for his earnest habit of calling the sun the sun, his mind puzzle is made uneasy by the solid statues which so obviously doubt his anti-mythological myth. Whatever, that's a bit too intense for me. Okay, reading port, and I have to apologise, I'm in the middle of Australia, it's the sun's out, there's been a bit of rain and there's cicadas everywhere, and hopefully I've set up the recording such that it's a little bit easier. It's a bit reduced, but there's very little I can do about it. More than 3,000 structures, nearly all stand of stone and scattered worldwide, stand witness to man's obsession with the sun. Most are built in line with the direction of the rising and setting, while some align just once a year, generally at a solstice, although the great Sphinx at Giza gazes out fixedly towards the vernal equinox. So that's, I don't know what vernal means, it's either the spring or autumn equinox of equal day and night. Whether one is looking at the first pillars of Stonehenge, dating from 2900 BC, the Mayan pyramids in Yucatan, the 12th century AD, the megaliths of the Great Plains down to the 19th century, or the dancing stones of Matamoraga on the grassy plains of Kenya, date unknown, there are the sun's silent celebrants. The majority of societies have erected monuments to the sun with extraordinary care. A large percentage of the mid-Neolithic tombs appear to have been built to face the sun at significant times, and in Britain alone there are 900 survive, above all Stonehenge, whose pillars Samuel Pepys recorded after visiting him in 1668, are as prodigious as any tales I've ever heard of them, and worth going this journey to see. He then added, and with his typical honesty, God knows what their use was. I have visited Stonehenge a dozen times. On occasions, it seems just a jumble of huge squat blocks without any special allure. At other times, such as Midsummer's Eve, it is so thronged with worshippers that it could be a country fair. But when all but deserted, at either sunrise or sunset, it's magical. And one's imagination soars. Against the lateral sunlight, the stones gain in beauty and majesty. For men to have made such a place at great effort shows how important the sun was to him. Present-day Stonehenge is the outcome of more than 5 millennia of building and accretion. So it's 5,000 years. It's 3,000 years or 5,000 years old and 5,000 years prior to that. During the first 6 centuries, a round enclosure took shape, formed by two banks of rust, chalky, dazzling, moon-white ditch. Okay, so that's the point that the ditch would have been white. With a circle of 56 picks were dug, each roughly a metre wide and deep. There was a break in the circle at the northeast, and the pillar 256 feet inward on the entrance. The famous Healstone, a corruption of the Welsh Hael, or Norse Hel, meaning both sun, is 16 feet high, descending another 4 feet below the ground, 8 feet in circumference, and some 35 tons in weight. On my visit on Midsummer's morning, I stood at the centre of the circle and watched the sun rise just to the left of the stone. Easy to believe, then, that the site was as much an observatory as a place of worship. Now, I should put it aside is that I had enough money to get to Europe, but had no money for transport. So, with my blind girlfriend, we had enough money to get to Salisbury, but not enough to Stonehenge. Quick, get out the map and the compass, and we walked from Salisbury through the fields to Stonehenge. And there is something about that, because you get the fields, the actual feeling of it. I think we walked there and back. What a trek. Yeah, that was a trek and a half. That's, I don't know how many kilometres that is. But the interesting thing is that when we came to Stonehenge, there was this obvious funeral mound away out from Stonehenge, and this is in someone's paddock across the road. And we stood on top of that and suddenly saw Stonehenge, obviously, with a circle of cyclone wire fencing and tourist buses coming up. And the sort of tourist buses are Stonehenge-shaped blocks to just break the thing between it. But there is something to actually walking there yourself. You actually walk through the countryside and you pick up on this. So I don't think he's mentioned these other satellite mounds outside. Between 2300 and 2000 BC, at least 82 upright slabs known as bluestones from the tint they assume in wet weather were floated, dragged and hauled some 250 miles from Crescent Mountains in southwest Wales to form a crescent at the centre of the circle. Over the next 400 years, a further ring of uprights consisting of 30 gigantic slab stones arranged in pairs that support lintels was added in a horseshoe-shaped curve. Its opening in the line of the sun's midsummer rising and winter solstice sunset. Okay, I sort of make that sound mentally. Nearly 23 feet high, these trillions, or three stones, trilithions, two uprights and a supporting lintel, each weighing some 45 to 50 tons, were cut from Saracen sandstone, a word suggesting a pagan origin, Saracen. Stonehenge first rates a mention in Historia Anglorum in 1130, so that's after 1066 and all that. However, that is all there is a mention. Not until 1740 did an English antiquary named William Suckle, well, obviously, he's contradicting himself, because in 1668 there was this Samuel Pepys, but here we go. An astronomical purpose to this mighty engineering feat, arguing that the sprinkles axis pointed towards the dawn of midsummer solstice. After Stukeley, who also advanced the notion, not stupidly, that Stonehenge might have been a racetrack, theories came fast and curious, curious, right down to the present day. It was a Bronze Age Lords, an ancient Druidic site, a prediction centre for eclipses, a monument to the dead, and the part of a funerary processional route. Many as 240 people are known to have been buried there. A tomb from Boadicea, a pagan queen from Iceland who led a revolt against the Romans, a mechanism for calculating a calendar, a solar and lunar observatory, a sophisticated forecaster of tides, curious for a place so far inland, and a monastery or college for the super elite who were a part of the worldwide prehistoric intelligentsia. That's really UFO-esque. All these centuries later, it's safe to say the scholars are firmly agreed on scarcely a single aspect of Stonehenge, although the weight of current research leans towards having been created as a cluster of a celestial observatory. Some to track the movements of the moons, others those of the sun, and possibly establish calendars.
I find this possibly a bit hard to believe. Maybe as archaeologist Shekeleta Hawkes once famously observed, every generation gets the Stonehenge it deserves and desires. Isn't that beautiful? With so many different theories, how can we tell the purpose of such buildings? Not just Stonehenge, but other monuments too. As Roland Hutton wryly notes, the people who build and use these great structures seem to have taken a positive delight in making exceptions to every rule which we try to discern in their behaviour. Point up in any direction, he suggests, and you will most likely hit a star or a phase in the sun or the moon. Nor does the notion of the monuments laid out according to sophisticated geometry consort well with the evidence on the ground. Quote, a glance at the plans of Wessex Superhinges will reveal that the classic shape is that of a battered car tyre. Many prehistoric monuments clearly have no connections with the exact occasions of summer and winter. For example, the stone figures or Maori of Easter Island, over 900 of them, average 20 feet in height, while they are probably performed some calendrical function, were based on lunar, not solar cycles. One tomb in the Isle of Arran faces the midsummer sunrise almost exactly, but 19 similar tombs on the island point in quite other directions. Mm-hmm. As Bruce Chatwin reports, the conversation between an Aborigine and a rough Australian in the songlines. The big man leered, if all what them says were sacred sites, there'd be 300 billion sacred sites in Australia. Not far wrong, mate, called the thin Aboriginals. So I think this is a hypocritical one. However, overall, the evidence is irresistible that by far the greater number of structures are consciously connected to the sun. And while Stonehenge may be the jewel and the crown of such prehistoric monuments, many of the lesser gems spread throughout the world. A particular favourite of mine is the burial mound in Newgrange, Lehemi Green, the Cave of the Sun, on the Irish, or the Irish Stonehenge, which lies in Bonnie Valley, about 30 miles north of Dublin, a megalithic burial place dating back to 3200 BC. It's roughly contemporary with the first Egyptian pyramid. From the outside, one sees a mass of dull stones on top of small hills. Inside is a place of wonder. At precisely 9:02 a.m. at the winter solstice, sunlight shines through a small window at the end of a 19-meter-long gallery. Now, look, I just have to say that they obviously had no clocks to click it through. And for the next 17 minutes, creeps along the passage until the eerie glow falls on a circular stone at the opposite wall of the otherwise dark little chamber. In his 2005 novel Ireland, Frank Delaney recreates the lives of those who built the burrow. Inside the central chamber, directly in line with the passageway, the tomb's creator, the architect, as in the novel, has placed a round, smooth dish of sand-coloured stone. It now resembles the elders within the tomb. Well, this is completely fictional. Okay. Now, the farthest end, but this is worthwhile to get you in there. What, you don't be held back by fiction. At the farthest end of the passageway, dredge golden-coloured thins the edges of the rectangular aperture, making it look like a box full of light. Next, a shaft of sunshine slid along through the box and lit the floor, just inside the entrance. The elders watched this glow and became transfixed steadily. With no jumps, no lurches, the light flowed down the passageway. Its golden yellow beam, thick as a man's arm, followed slowly. It was as though the light was honey from a bowl, and someone tipped it over and spilled it in a long, direct channel. When the sunbeam reached the edge of the chamber, its yellow-orange began to glow upwards into a gathering, gliding the elder's face. The ray seemed to hesitate for a moment, and then it surged forward until it splashed into the great stone dish. And it filled it exactly. Not a drop of sunshine shipped through the edge there or anywhere in the final resting place of the sun, for that brief moment was precisely within the full circumference of the bowl, leaving no area of the bowl's stone surface dark or cold. It lay there like a golden sphere. Okay, well, I was going to say, obviously, this is just a fiction, but an imagination. Stonehenge's greatest rival among the prehistoric monuments of Europe is not Newgrange, which is the Irish one. However, it's the forest of alignments of stone circles, dolmen, burial places formed from great graven stones, and talmany, earthen tombs, stretching beyond the remote seaside town of Cagnac on the southern coast of Brittany. I've actually been there. Some 10,000 megaliths, notably the Grand Mahir Brise at Loch Mahir, a massive edifice who once rose 60 feet, but now lies shattered into five parts, each about 340 tons, huddled together like so many battle-weary giants. Okay, he loves it. Yeah, telling us a bit of poetry he's got into his words. Local legend has it that the Roman soldiers were literally petrified by Pope Cornelius during the scission of AD 251 to 3. Well, there you go. I'd love to know about that one. I'll have to... Unfortunately, my memory's not good enough. I'm not going to remember to look that up. The site boasts several burial chambers, deep caverns faced towards the rising sun, a powerful index of the likely interest of things solar amongst those who dwelt there in the New Stone Age. It's among the great stones of Lochmere, and Porthos meets his death. Okay. In The Man in the Iron Mask, okay, which is also fictional, covering Arim's escape from the company of the King's Guards after being trapped inside one of the great caves. Most countries in Europe have... Why tell me fiction? There's a huge amount of things. Most countries in Europe have at least one major site of ancient solar reference. The most impressive constructions are hardly limited to one continent, however. Halfway around the world, an extraordinary temple sits within the complex of buildings makes up Angkor Wat in Cambodia. Constructed between 1113 and 1150, it forms part of the largest astronomically sited building in the world. The temple, called a Wat, is almost a mile across. It was designed both as a tomb for its creator, Suraviman II, and as an observatory. Nearly every measurement encodes calendrical information, and the bas-reliefs are all orient west to catch the setting sun. Well, you would think so. You know, if you're going to do something, you want it to be lit up and shaved. There are five particularly grand solar temples in India, all now in ruins, at Delhi, Konrak, Madan, Ranpur, and Rajasthan, and Moderna in Gujarat. In October 2006, I visited the one in Moderna, built in AD 1026, about 200 years before the next oldest at Konrak. Okay, so this is the old one. The shrines lie about 6 miles from the state's former capital, Patan. And survival is the more surprising given it lies in an earthquake zone badly hit in 1918, again in 65, and once more on January 25th, 2000, when the shock registered 7.9 on the Richter scale. My guy, a Brahmin who was converted to Buddhism, so a Brahmin is a Hindu, explained to me that unlike the peoples of Europe and the Americas, Hindus never try to face the sun directly, which is why statues of the Indian gods look eastward, with a hand held up for blessing, so anyone looking at the god catches the sun's reflection. Temple domes are designed in the shape of massive lingams, or whatever that means, yet one more tribute to the sun's potencies. The solar-oriented monuments assume an amazing variety of forms. In North America, for instance, the Indian Great Plains positions medicine, magical wheels to register the sun's course, each wheel consisting of a central circle or a rock pile from which radiate spokes of stones. These creations can range up to 100 metres in diameter, where the hub may be 10 metres across and several metres high. They are found along the eastern boundary of the Rocky Mountains from Colorado to Alberta and Saskatchewan. One dubbed, quote, the American Stonehenge, unquote, sits on top of the Medicine Mountain in Bighorn Range of north central Wyoming. Of course, that would be extremely disappointing to see, I would assume. In Salem, New Hampshire, this is a witch place, stands a rival American Stonehenge. So, what's... one's in Wyoming. So, let me read this one. The sandstone edifice was held sacred by several Plains tribes and a line through two of its cairns, stone memorial mounds, lines up with a third of a degree with the exact point of the sunrise and summer solstice. And so in Salem, New Hampshire, stands a rival American Stonehenge, a complex of cairns, chambers and huts between 4,000 and 3,000 years old, encircled by a notch sighting stones aligned with the sunrise and sunset. Each series of markings, the site also celebrates cross-quarter holidays, which fall halfway between the solstice and the equinox. Oh, that's pretty interesting. Americans... holidays? What? Cross-quarter. So this is not quite equinox. This is when the rate of change... Why? It's hard to work out what the heck... And why they're having holidays. The Americans are particularly rich in such places. North, east, St. Louis, Missouri, over 100 mounds dating from 800 to 1000... 1550, and covering 16 acres from the largest prehistoric earthwork in the world, many of the mounds are arranged along the sunrise line of the winter solstice. Elsewhere, some are more than elaborate burial tumuli, while others served as temples of great effigies of gods as fortifications. Or they don't really have to know whether it's fortifications. The Maya, the Aztec, the Inca all constructed such works too. At Chiclayon, literally, where men becomes gods, in the present state of Jalisco, rise 600 pyramids of various sizes dominated by, this would be worth going to see, a great pyramid of the sun, one of the three temples covering over an acre, and aligned east-west, suggesting they functioned too as solar observatories. They were built between 300 BC and 200 AD, one of the three being initially slightly misaligned, which is a fault so upset the Montezuma that he had it raised and rebuilt, an act of intellectual integrity amongst a supposedly inferior people, so established Cortes that he reported this to his king, whatever that means. Further south, the entire Mayan city of Chichen Itza in southeastern Mexico was devoted to astronomical observations, the windows of its spiral tower being set towards the solstice and equinox. While travelling in Peru, I saw temples in the sun at Machu Picchu, at Cuzco, and all similarly disposed. Cuzco and Chichen Itza both boast rows of pillars that divide the sun's movements into periods, roughly corresponding to the months, helping farmers determine the time for sowing. I've also seen, you think that animals, they'd use animal clues or other plants would start to grow. You think it's just not, you know, you think that the farmers would be so connected they wouldn't have to go, gee, I've got to check my iPad. Okay. I've seen solar markers on hillsides overlooking the island of the sun in Lake Titicaca. No wonder that in the last 30 years there has risen the discipline of astroarchaeology, which combines archaeology with astronomy. Most of the research so far published tells the same story, of course, of sun worship united with practical scientific purpose and cultural celebration. Quote, to you, to me, wrote W.H. Auden, which is quoted at the front, Stonehenge and Chartres cathedrals are the works of the same ancient man under different names. We know that he, capital He as a god, did and even what he thought and he believed in. But we don't know why, and the why is becoming clearer. The desire that places of worship should be also serve a practical function. That's bizarre. What is noteworthy is how societies living on the margin pour so much of their resources into constructions extracting colossal communal efforts normally associated with major wars. They said that this is sort of building things like Sydney Opera House or Sydney Harbour Bridge is a nation building. Around 1960, now we get half a dozen people on computers building out these huge concrete computer design things and it just doesn't feel nation building. People have to die building it. Around 1967, a NASA scientist declared that getting man to the moon was the national integrative effect of modern times, paralleled with Egypt's turning itself into one nation by building pyramids. Okay, well, this is a similar thing. The moon space race took so many people. Now we do it, it's hard to get people involved. Worldwide, many ancient stone constructions have been so carefully crafted that they have lost nothing of their accuracy. Oh, dear. But it happened to be of stone, not of wood. Okay, but because the Earth shifts its position over time, about 1 degree every 72 years. Okay, precession is 22,000 years to do, or 23,000, or that's what, 24,000 years to do, 360 degrees shift. So that's a bit under 1,000 years per degree. So that's about right. That's for the movement of our sun, which also tells you that our star signs are out well, let's say from Christ, it's about 2 degrees, and there's how many star signs, the star signs are out by a significant number of degrees, not by a whole month, but let's work this one out. So I understand that. So let's see. Travelling in India in the autumn of 2006, I visited the famous Janta Mata instrumental calculation at Jatama, one of the 5 observatories that was erected in Maharaja Sawajing Singh II. The grandest of them all, consisting of 16 huge instruments in pink and yellow limestone and marble, set down in the vast park like a giant's playground. Throughout the observatory, the instruments still function effectively, although the one that measured the equinoxes was slightly off because of the Earth's recession. Okay, so this is the entire thing, that if you build a monument, they're off. So I'm just trying to work that out, what it means in terms of equinox and precession. Let's really think about that. The sun's shadow should have crossed from one side of the wall to the other on the 32nd, 21st of September, but while I was there, it did not do so for 2 more days. So that gives you a good reason. Samuel Johnson's hero, Rasselas, describes the pyramids of Egypt as, quote, the greatest work of man except for the Wall of China. Well, he's a fictional, an author who's got a fictional man. To other visitors, they appear the sun's rays made of stones. However, I think it's interesting that they're not 45 degrees. I think the angle up is 50 degrees. It's just enough to really, if they're 45 degrees, that looks stupid. 50 degrees is great. So this is the angle up. This is, it's hard to work out what they're talking about. Okay, let's go back. However, describe the supreme manifestation of the hierarchy, whose kings were inextricably linked to the sun, who commissioned these astonishing structures as tombs for themselves and their families. Each tomb symbolized the primeval mound that grew up from the waters during the world's creation. It was believed to form a gigantic stairway to the heavens, where the pharaoh's soul would become one with the immortal stars. There you go. That we say stars is an immortal being. The two great monuments of solstice, moments of solstice, and towards the east, the pyramids were aligned, were seen as gateways to the royal souls on their journey to, into and out of life. Just as the empirical facts take one's breath away, the great pyramids of the pharaoh of Khufu in Giza, on the outskirts of where the ancient metropolis of Memphis once stood, Cairo now spreads all over the site, is the oldest and sole survivor of the 7 wonders of the ancient world, and is ranked for millennia as the tallest structure on earth. Natolian, fascinated by all things Egyptians, calculated there was enough stone in the 3 great pyramids of Giza to build a wall 3 minutes high. He neglected to say how thick around the whole of France. Oh, there you go. Although there were imitations in Thebes and elsewhere, the first ones were built in Middle Egypt. The Egyptians knew next to nothing of engineering. They're stupid people. They simply multiplied wedges, levers, and inclined plans by enormous manpower. Yet the maximum inconsistency between the side lengths of the Great Pyramid is astonishing, less than 0.1%. Herodotus asserts that the Great Pyramid was built by 100,000 slaves. A more credible figure is 25,000. And it wasn't slaves, it was free people, you know, fed on onions and garlics, who laid down an average of 340 blocks a day over 2 cruel decades. Well, there you go. People now believe it wasn't cruel, and I'd be surprised if they ate a garlic-built pyramid. The most intense period of pyramid building stretched from 2686 BC down to 2345 BC. Beyond the Great Pyramids, there was about 18 primary sites and some 29 others, each part of which is a single architectural complex. About a hundred of these monuments were built, put together from polished pearly white limestone, red granite, quartzite, alabaster, mud brick, and clay lime mortar. Okay, you can imagine this is, you know, your clay lime mortar is what you get at the end if you're just no good as a pharaoh. The lights rest on a base of 756 feet square. That's actually not too much. You take the square root of 700, and that's stupid. That's a ridiculously small quantity. So 756. Just my head's hurting. There's 16 squared, 600. So it's roughly 16 feet by 16 feet. Oh, that's stupid. That story. And the inclination is just over 50 degrees. The true derivation of the word pyramids has various contenders. The ancient Egyptians term per et mit has been variously translated as division by 10, division of number, division of perfection, fire in the middle. The Greeks, possibly jealous, are said to have taken up the derivative term for the structures pyramids, meaning either the little wheaten cakes sold in the treat stalls or some stores' houses of grain. This would have been some justification to the latter bar. Christian Europe during the Middle Ages based its idea of Egypt mainly on the Bible, assuming the pyramids were Joseph's grain storehouses, described in Genesis, and calling them the barns of Abraham. Well, there you go. Isn't that amazing? Okay, this is what's so good about this book. See how many pages we've got to go. I should be able to knock this one out. The very first pyramid, which is also the world's oldest existing construction of stone, was built in Sakwa, 16 miles south of Cairo, at the beginning of the Dynasty III. I think find that really is an astonishing fact to just pop out there. The cult of Ra reached its zenith under the Dynasty number 5, which is civil, but by which time the pharaoh, which means great house, but I thought you gave me a different term of pharaoh before, didn't you? Did you give me a different term of pharaoh? What did you do? I think he gave me a different term of pharaoh before. Okay. Great house, in reference to his final residence, had become identified as sons of the sun god, as he did before. I think sure have. So pyramid means a division. Isn't that beautiful? Nusseri is from 2465 to 2325, so he lived a fair while. That's 35 and 25 is 60. Sixth king of Dynasty number 5 even had his burial pyramid at Abu Jerib in Lower Egypt made smaller than his son's temple as a mark of respect and possibly fear. This is weird. During the reign of Akhenaten and his wife Netefifi, which is a very most famous one, if you go to Egypt, they just bang on about this woman, between 1379 and 1362 BC, the sun was the all-embracing deity of the three kingdoms. Okay, you were upper, middle, and lower. After Akhenaten's time, he was demoted from the supreme godhood, but was still an object of worship. Ramesses II, 1279 to 1213 BC, had two temples cut out of the living rock on the east bank of the Nile, southwest of Aswan, in what today is northern Sudan. The taller edifice, I think I've been to this one, the taller edifice, 1,119 feet, based to the summit. Four colossal stone gods, I saw this, 67 feet high, atop which stands a row of carved sacred baboons. The Watchers of Dawn, who also allies Ra in casting back the force of night, are depicted in the arms raised in adoration of the rising sun. The temple is oriented so that, on the 22nd February and the 22nd October, interestingly 8 months apart, not six, the morning sun fills the entire length of the elaborate passageway carriage. Chamber, as in New Grange, and illuminates the four of the fire gods against the black wall, the innermost shrine, but not that of Pa, the primal creature who dwells in the dark. So I believe that I've gone to see this one, and what's great is I think this was one relocated because of the Aswan Dam filling up. And you go in, you have a look at it, and you go, is that a very fine crack? And then you go back and look at the back. It's all a hollow reconstruction by Egyptian engineering. And it was so you go in the back of this monument, and it's all just steel girders in the inside holding it up. Pretty sad. The pyramids have been subject to almost as many of these stone hinges. Unlike the great monuments, they clearly had a powerful connection with the solstice. Their basic orientation established by wooden stakes and ropes. It was at first north to south, the solstice axis, and then with those built from the 4th dynasty on, east to west, the axis of the equinox. Even though the entrances remained in the north face, the Egyptologist Martin Ezer explains that had to be what had to be accomplished. And here's a quote. The linkage between the rising sun and the pyramid oriented its side to the cardinal points is straightforward. As the sun travels from winter to summer solstice, it moves along the horizon in an arc of about 50 degrees from north to south latitude at Giza. To equate the king's pyramid with the sun, requires the sides of the structure to face due east and west. Due east is midway point for the sun as it moves between the summer and winter solstice. It's also the only position in a structure square in the plan can have one side face the birth of the sun in the east, another face the death in its west, and still have the north side directed to the circumpolar stars. I just have to really... I think this is absolutely mad. Most pyramids ordered in the equinox were aligned so that, on that date, they seemed to swallow the setting sun, which must have only have increased the witnesses' awe. Their orientation also allowed them to be used as a mark of the sun's course. An ancient text refers to the shadow of Ra and the stride of Ra, so that they served as both solar temples and as seasonal clocks. God, this is stupid. Oh, I think he's missed out the whole point about obelisks, the entire thing of obelisks and shadow length measuring. I hope he's done that. So obelisks are these long... you saw it has one, the obelisk factory. So what they do is they make an obelisk and actually ship them up the Nile, these long poles, and put them out to see the shadows. Okay, so I think this is mad if he hasn't mentioned this. The whole civilizations have married their concepts of time and space with their relationships to their gods, creating a bridge between heaven and earth. However, religiously oriented commemoration, solstice points, and the solar phenomena are not the work of only ancient or pre-civilized societies. The gate cathedrals of Europe face east to declare this sacredness. No, they're faced towards, I think, Rome. Oh no, Jerusalem. I think. Although Pope Leo the Great, 400 to 461, forbade Christians to worship the rising sun, its veneration was deemed acceptable so long as the sun was seen as a symbol of Christ entering the church. The document more easily decreed than a force to prevent sunlight, which was both distraction and arrival, from streaming through the church's open doorways. Pope Vigilius commanded that all places of worship face their apse rather than the main entrances east to west. Now, I think he's really mad. As far as I know, churches tend to face Jerusalem, which makes it rather strange. Okay, that might be true. I'm trying to think the orientation of... only occasionally was this visitation granted for a cathedral to have its doorway aligned with the sunrise of the winter solstice and the setting sun of the summer solstice, or it would lie its main axis facing the rising sun on the day of special significance such as the Patron Saint's Festival. Medieval man would talk of walking windishins, meaning that it would bring harm to walk around the church in the opposite movement to the sun. Walking sunwise around the freestanding megalithic monuments survived from the remotest part. And even in the 17th century, in parts of Scotland, local people walked sunwise around the stone called Martin Dressel, a Gaelic word for clockwise being Greece.
What I don't quite understand, it's interesting, if clockwise is, if our preference for clockwise is there, and the fact that east and west suns, and I think they've done archaeological digs and saying that for some reason the origin towards left-handed people has dwindled. So in ancient times, in ancient digs, Stone Age man, there was many as left-handed as right-handed people, and the tools has meant that right hands become more dominant over time. So I find this hard to believe, because I believe that church is always pointed towards the east. The other thing is that I believe that churches are designed on the shape of people. Famously, the dome is the breast and the legs pointing upwards are the steeples, and the grand entrances are the vaginal entrances. No matter that the church goes through such periodic renunciations of the sun, the fact remains that holy days are rooted in pagan solar festivities, and the astronomers who study the sun have for centuries been in the employ of the church. I have walked across a 1798 Gammon, a marked surface that shows the time by registering the shadow of the cast sun outside the church of Bergamento in northern Italy. I think the other thing is that they always used to have sundials on churches before they got bells. Another Gammon, once established the spring equinox, stands at the side in the rustic or rose line that runs along the nave of Saint-Sulpice in Paris, made newly famous by the Da Vinci Code. There's a long history of telescopes being placed in Italian cathedrals, and during the 17th and 18th century, the cathedrals of Bologna, Rome, and Florence and Paris all served as solar observatories. Across the Atlantic, St. Mark's Church in the Bowery was built and concentrated in 1799 at what is now Slyvant Street in the lower 2nd Avenue, Manhattan. After the fire in 1978, the restorers uncovered a rose window on the south wall aligned with the altar. In 1983, a stained glass window succeeded it, so that at noon, the spring equinox of the sun strews the nave with coloured lights. I don't know where this is going. As with the sacred, so with the secular. Some 2 miles to the north, in the plaza of McGraw Hill Building in the 6th Avenue of 48th Street, stands a 50-foot steel sun triangle installed in 1973. The superside points towards the sun's zenith at the highest summit, the lowest arm to the place at noon on the first day of winter, around the 22nd, 1st December. Another recent example of the huge sundial bridge built by the Spanish architecture and sculptor and structural engineer at San Diego Calavana between 1996 and 2004. Tilted like a catapult, ready to be sprung. Oh, God. It spans Sacramento River in Redding, California, north-south alignment, making the pile and shadow indicate the time of day. Well, that's actually quite strange. Twice a year, in the borough of Manhattan, the sun performs a neat trick of its own. Because most of the island is laid out on a grid, and the grid is canted at 28.9 degrees east and true north, the rays of the rising and setting sun are essentially at right angles to its great avenues. This meant that on the 30th of May 2009, the setting sun could be seen shining right down all the borough's east-west streets at once. From 14th Street, where the city grid proper begins, on and up. In the days immediately after, the point of sunset continued to shift north right up until the summer solstice, 3.5 weeks later. Thereafter, the point migrated southwards again, until the sunsets were once more lined up with the Manhattan's cross seats on the 11th of July at 8:27 p.m. Perhaps Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden... Planetarium suggests anthropologists in the distant future will presume Manhattan grid to have some astronomical sequence, just as we found in Four Stonehenge. There's a lot of things I'll have to check up on this.
another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.